All you have to do is be your being. That's really what I'm trying to bring.
Wait, what?
This is the Extra Hot Crate Podcast, episode 313 for the week of July 27th, 2020. I am largest bed dipper David T. Cole, and I'm here with Rage Scream Sarah D. Bunting.
Goop!
Ecstatic Dancer Tara Arianna.
The Ecstatic Dancer!
And Shamanic Skeptic Joshua Rivera.
Let's go on a journey.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us for the very first time, Joshua Rivera from The Verge. Hello, Joshua.
Hello.
Joshua.
Hello.
Yay! We are here to talk about TBS's Lost Resort. Now, we'll get into why this is on TBS and not Bravo, because I have questions. But this is about and set at a wellness resort in the middle of a Costa Rican jungle under the guidance of spiritual leader Chrissy, who has an Australian accent, but apparently trained with Peruvian shamans.
When you train, you don't get the accent, so that tracks.
Okay. Holistic health coach Benjamin, ecstatic dance and Reiki leader Atasie, and mindfulness leader Onika. Nine seekers have come to try to identify their emotional wounds, cleanse them, put Neosporin on them spiritually, and recover from them. We're going to watch them. So I was expecting this to be a below deck kind of Bravo type show where the viewer would be encouraged to mock the rich guests. The staffers would be getting into scraps behind the scenes. Then all of a sudden, we're hearing about people's extremely real personal tragedies in some cases. Joshua, you chose the show from among the week's premieres. Did you also feel like this was kind of a bait and switch given the show's logline? Or is this pretty much what you were expecting going into it?
Yeah, I was completely blindsided. It does not bill itself as it sort of like puts the premise before the people when it you know, in like the commercials and everything like that. Yeah. So it's sort of like, oh, look at like all this, you know, new age stuff you're supposed to be skeptical about, you know, and it immediately, like when it introduces the characters, it like list their name and like not their occupation, but their issue, like what their deal is. And I was, so very, very much caught by surprise there. Especially given how light reality TV programming can be.
Right. And especially the kind of part of it, I think, is like what you want also in these days. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't quite the pairing of tone and current situation that we were all craving from a show that is about, you know, spoiled Americans in, you know, some eco tourist resort in Costa Rica. Like, it wasn't quite the match of expectation and want and what was delivered, for sure.
Yeah. Sarah, as someone who's watched participants seek therapy on shows like Teen Mom or Marriage Boot Camp, how effective do you think TV therapy is generally? How effective do you think this treatment specifically is likely to be based on what we saw in the first episode?
Okay, well, thank you for not outing me as a watcher of both Celebrity Rehab and Sober House. I'll just do it myself. Also, the one who is still watching Intervention. This began to feel increasingly icky to me. Like, as far as televised therapy goes, like, I think this could be just as effective as anything else, depending on how well the participants are able to divorce the, like, Heisenberg observation quality of it all from the proceedings. But this is not, like, abandonment issues, like, you know, I just want to get on TV, I have mommy issues. That, like, these people have suffered real legitimate trauma ongoing sometimes. And this feels really cheap and exploitive, like, particularly since the show is also trying to do, I don't know how else to put this, but remember like 20 years ago when spam was both still selling itself seriously as a product to be consumed, but also ironically as a like t-shirt to wear. This is doing that with alternative therapies. And it's like, which is it? Like, you're making fun of it, or you're hoping to bail out people who are really struggling from like childhood sexual assault. I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm not trying to say that I am better than this kind of content. Let's be clear. I'm saying that this particular content is like, feels particularly egregious.
It felt to me like they gathered some people with, and I'm going to say some, I don't want to paint a picture that all these people that they've gathered have real issues, because some of them don't, by at least the first episode.
I think rudeness is not trauma. Yeah. Yes, I agree.
And, Greg.
So they gathered all these people, and some of them have genuine, deep-rooted issues, and they gave them all coupons for, you know, therapy, and that's what this show is. Like, it's budge, low-rate, TV-first therapy, and it's definitely not the right thing for a lot of these people to be engaging in, and it's sort of like... Yep. That ickiness like stains the show right away. Like, they either have to make the show a serious affair, which TBS, a serious affair just set my
activated
iPhone.
Siri.
They either have to make this a serious affair, or they have to go the other way and sort of go the more Bravo-esque route of saying, okay, all these people are just people that you will people watch with their false problems. To me, watching this, I was like, oh, I thought I escaped when it started. I thought I escaped the Goop Lab. But here we are, Goop Lab, the reality show, is now in front of me. It's not quite that, but it's pretty close. Until, like, you get the pastor who had
a baby die at birth.
Yeah, a die at birth. Yeah. And you're like, oh, okay, we're well beyond Goop territory. But that's where I thought they were, and then they go beyond that, and I'm like, well, I can't really enjoy this show. I'm not quite sure what level they want me to engage with this show, because they seem to want to have their cake and eat it too, but it's not working out that way.
Yeah,
I also think it foregrounds like sort of like the dirty secret of reality TV, which is that it, as a rule, kind of looks for people to exploit, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and you know, with a lot of these same issues are what makes them a good reality show contestants, regardless of the premise, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that just feels dirty, you know? Like, but also in a way that sort of like, you know, like Sarah said, you know, I can't say that I'm above it, because I watch other reality shows where like people are just clearly, you know, like...
unwell.
I would say Love Is, you know, some of the Love Is Blind contestants, you know, should probably work some things out off of television, you know? Like, it's sort of like brings out the darker parts of just this genre of television.
Right. Because when you have to cast for entertainment, sort of like, you often, you know, you get this, right? Where you get this terrible mix.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I felt too. Like, it seemed like a typical reality show format was created, and then some typical reality show people were dumped into it, along with people who have problems that were bigger than the setting could accommodate. Like, for example, Robin and Christine are a mother and daughter. They arrive together and they say that their issue is that they're codependent. I'm sure that's true. But then they also say they fight so much they can't be together for more than a half an hour, which is like, how are you codependent then? Okay, fine, whatever. Or there's Miko, who, in addition to, she says in passing, like, she's just been in a mass shooting, and it feels like they never come back to that. But then on top of that, she was like abandoned as a baby in a garbage can and then went into the foster care system, and now is like so closed off that when they try to get her to talk about anything, she's like, I'm fine. Like, okay. Like, I don't think so, but sure. Like, it just seems like Robin and Christine, yes, this is a format for you. And of course they make them bunk together, even though it seems like it's obvious they would benefit from being separated some of the time. Like, but of course, cause it's a reality show, they're not. But, you know, like Becca, Miko, some of these other people, like, get out of here, right. Please. place.
Yeah, Becca's the pastor.
Becca is the pastor who, yeah, since the death of her baby at birth, has felt disconnected from God, and that was 5 years ago. So this is like not just an emotional crisis, but also like a professional one where spiritually she is no longer feeling, you know, her vocation and her calling. And it's like, this is maybe bigger than Benjamin, the holistic health healer, can deal with.
Well, and like, she's screaming at God, and then a maraca is happening. And I hope that this helped her. But like, that was something that I felt that I should not be present for.
Yeah.
And I watched Love After Lockup. Like, again, I would like to stress that I am better than exactly no people. But this really just felt like I don't think the two sides of this, of what this show thinks it can be, can coexist.
Yeah.
And you totally get whiplash.
Because we shouldn't see this.
Yeah, because some of the people got problems, like Krusty the Clown has like a condor egg omelet problem. Like, it's not a real problem, right? And some of these people are like, yikes, I feel bad watching this because I feel like I'm a peeping Tom into your stuff. I know you went on the show and everything, but that's the problem with the duality of what they're presenting here. Is just like, it doesn't mix.
Yeah.
And the show also sort of like encourages you at some points to just watch it like you would a regular reality show, like, right? Like, oh God, I forgot the contestant that has anger management issues, right? There are parts of it where they sort of like look like they're trying to encourage you to be like, does this person really have the problem they say they do? And like, that's gross, you know?
Yeah.
And there are aspects of the show where, like, if it didn't have that sort of like winky reality show production and its presentation, would be incredibly hard television, but also incredibly like just raw affecting television, right? Like the rage session that the episode builds to, like you put like, you know, a Peter Berg Friday Night Lights aesthetic on that, right? And that's very raw and real and potentially affecting, right? If these people are legitimately working through their pain, and the creators, participants in the audience are all playing fair with each other. It could be something meaningful, and instead it feels like something that's just gross.
Yeah. It's like the difference between this and if anyone else watched Couples Therapy on Showtime last year, where it felt like you followed the same few couples through a whole, you know, season's worth of therapy. It felt very intimate. There was no sensationalistic about it. It was just like the therapist and the couples in their sessions. I think you rarely followed them home, or else, you know, you saw them giving talking heads afterwards about what their reactions were to, you know, the advice that they were getting or how they felt and stuff. But it was mostly just like them in therapy. And it felt like the experience of actually doing it versus this, where it's like when you're seeing them in the between times when they're like just hanging out in their casitas and, you know, it's Greg being like, I'm sick of Robin and Christine already. Like, what? Again, whiplash is the perfect word for it, where it's like, this is not the right format for what you think you're presenting, you know.
It's two different shows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also called Lost Resort. Like,
yeah,
that sounds something more survivory, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I honestly thought at the start of this episode, before things got dark, that they were actually going to kick somebody off each week. Like, sorry, no more therapy for you. Boom. Like, you had to be on your best behavior to order to get, you know, help. Yeah,
that's not a breakthrough. Get out. Yeah.
Yeah. What would be the kiss off line then? Like, I'm sorry, you'll have to heal thyself. Like, how do you even do that?
Sorry, get lost.
Yeah. Before we leave this show behind, I just, because it's been so long since we had one, I feel the need to do it.
Let the wide stick give you the edge. Speed Stick Super Dry Antiperspirant.
Lost Resort. All right, it's time to go around the dial. We're going to talk about something we've been watching on TV lately. Our first stop is with Tara.
Ariana. First, an update on Married at First Sight Australia, since I talked about it on the podcast. What?
Yeah, no, I just, like, it's funny to me that you're watching a different version of Married at First Sight.
Well,
like, you just got to get more.
No, what I'm about to say is I ended up bailing on it because it had so many couples. I couldn't keep them all straight or hook into any of their stories. Several episodes into the season, they were still having like new weddings with new couples. I didn't understand how the format worked at all. Plus, then I read that Married at First Sight America was coming back this month. So I decided to just wait for that instead. Now here it is. Episode 3 will air this week. So this show also has more couples than I would like, to be honest. In the first several seasons, it was 3. And then they did 4 for a couple of seasons. I was like, okay. And now it's 5. And it's like, this is really too much. But I'm never going to quit, I guess. Still is making me keep track of a lot of people, which is just,
it's the same trajectory as the Batman movies. More, more, more. Scarecrow and
yes,
his wife. What?
And some of them are villains, too, super villains. Anyway, this is mean to me personally because I usually don't know anyone's name for like the first 6 episodes of any seasons. Over the weekend, I tweeted that last week I didn't want to talk about anything except Alex for the next 9 hours. There's no Alex. Like, I just made that up.
I'm still not sure what first name of the dragon lady from Game of Thrones is, to be honest with you.
Daenerys?
I don't know.
Oh, I think I'm pretty sure that's
okay.
It. Anyway, the guy I'm thinking of is Bennett, if you're also watching this season. For those of you who are new listeners and have never heard me talk about the show before, the premise of Married at First Sight is exactly what you think. A bunch of experts, air quotes, choose from a pool of singles in a given city. They match up always straight couples with each other, and they don't know anything about each other until they meet at the altar, and then they get married, and then the cameras follow them for the 6 weeks or 8 weeks or whatever of the experiment. And then at the end of it, they have to decide if they want to stay married. As I said, it's so many couples there that were 2 episodes in. They haven't even done all of the weddings yet, but there have already been 2 catastrophes.
Oh.
First,
what does that mean?
Well, I'm going to tell you. Okay. Karen, that's really her name. It's not a terribly offensive slur.
Sorry, Karen.
She got a text right before her wedding that was supposed to go to someone else, but she got it by accident, or possibly accident, air quotes. And it included her groom's full name. So she looked him up on Instagram, as you would, and then watched all of his Instagram stories, and then called a producer like into the bathroom of the room where they were getting ready for the wedding, and was like, he's not really my type.
Wait, I'm wondering.
Yeah.
Why doesn't she get the full name of the person that they want her to marry? That seems like at minimum the information that you
Dave, they don't get any information about them until they meet at the altar. You can't Google them beforehand. You don't know anything at all about the person.
Got it.
At all.
Not okay.
Nothing.
Hmm.
Any of the times that I've talked about this show, you've never listened to me talk about it.
I kind of just figured Married at First Sight just meant like, you know, I didn't realize it was at the actual altar in front of the pastor or whatever.
Yes, it is.
That's
they have zero information. They don't even know their first name.
This is how we introduced marrying dogs into America for real, just like everybody feared. We started on Married at First Sight.
Honestly, some of these people would be lucky marrying dogs compared to who the experts match them with.
It's not the worst thing in the world.
I'm being dead serious. Yeah. Anyway, back to the show. So she calls the producer and is like, I'm not into this guy. But then she marries him anyway. Even though midway through the ceremony, she starts like sobbing, but then still goes through with it. So keep an eye on these two as she increasingly, presumably regrets this decision. The other one is with Bennett, the guy who I thought was named Alex.
Not even close.
I don't know how they found these two. Okay, Alex. No, Bennett. Bennett. He is a weirdo. He owns like a tiny theater company, and they put on these like tiny black box theater productions. He goes for his tux fitting with like 3 of his female friends, and he brings this like Indian baseball cap that's like all festooned with like sequins and an elephant and stuff. And he's like, I want you to build my outfit around this, and puts it on. And all of his friends are like, no. And then one of the tuxedo store is like, I will not. They finally talk him out of it. He ends up going with like a jacket with like personality, but he's like a character.
Oh, God.
And then they match him with this woman who is a medical student. She's studying to be a doctor, who also like in her spare time enjoys unicycling. Her name is Amelia. I want to know which of them they found first and then found the other one to match them with. Both of these fucking nerds, because they are not typical Married at First Sight people at all. And I should hate them both. And yet I like them and I'm rooting for them. They are cute.
I don't know anything about them, but yes. I want to believe that both of them in their past lives were the two leads from that movie about the balloon that goes too high.
Uh-huh. Oh.
The Balloonist or whatever.
Oh.
The Aeronauts.
The aeronauts.
The aeronauts. Yeah, they were the aeronauts.
Yeah, kind of. They have aeronauts vibes. That's fair.
I heard the Air Nuts. I was happier when I thought something was named that. Anyway.
So Amelia, for her wedding, does an updo with like a little, she does a bird fascinator like stuck in it. And she also doesn't shave her armpits. So like, God bless you for living your truth. Like, make sure your groom knows who you are at the altar with like bridal pit hair. God bless. Also, her three attendants are all in like different jewel-toned fringed dresses. Really bright, all look like they are for sure rayon, and then one of them unicycles down the aisle with the other two holding her arms because she doesn't know how to unicycle. Like, why would you make someone do this? And I'm surprised that the fringe did not get caught in the unicycle and like kill her.
Oh, yeah,
that didn't happen. So then the doors open. Amelia looks at Bennett, not
Alex.
She says to whoever is walking her down the aisle, "I've met him before." And then he looks at her. He's like, "I know her." And so it's not married at first sight. They totally know each other. So it's unclear yet, because this was the end of the episode, how well they know each other. But they've at least met.
They're probably siblings.
That's incredible.
Oh, no.
I mean, but up until now, it just sounds like a merger between two very successful Tumblr accounts. But like,
Joshua, you fucking nailed it. Yep. 100%. So
my name is not alex.tumblr.com. Oh yeah.
So we see in the scenes from next week that when he gets to his vows, he's like, gonna have to do some editing on the fly here, but I'm rooting for these two because I should hate them and yet I like them and I don't know why. He also before the wedding, he's like, "I'm going to have to wear these white tube socks with my tuxedo because they're the only socks I have that have no holes in them." And none of his groomsmen who are like in the hotel room with him chilling before the wedding are like, "I'll go out and buy you some socks," because that's the kind of guy he is. And that's the kind of guy his friends are. Like, it doesn't occur to any of them, like, "We have hours. I'll just go to fucking Macy's." Like, this is obviously pre-quarantine times. Anyway. The other couple that is potentially going to be a problem is Brett and Olivia, because in the previous two seasons, season 9 and season 10, they have been two couples where the guy thought he was really, really way hotter than the woman that he was matched with. And yeah. In one case, that was true. Sorry. I won't say which. In the other case, it was like they were really on equal footing. And in this case, I'm not going to say this guy is ugly. He is not as hot as he thinks he is, though. And like in his intake interviews, one of the experts was like, "What happens if she gets to the altar and she's not attracted to you?" And he's like, "Well, I'm really attractive, so I don't think that'll happen." And they cut back to her and she's like, "Okay." Like, he's not hideous. He's not like a bridge troll, but like his face is, I'm going to say, 30 to 35%. Nostril, like he's not a classically,
he's open for business
handsome man.
Yeah.
And so,
I have just googled these individuals and the power differential does not favor Brett.
No,
in my opinion.
And yet
he is nostrily as hell.
I'm pretty sure, even though after he met her he's like, she's really attractive, and when he finds out that she works out 5 days a week or whatever, he's like, "Great, because so does he, blah blah blah." They're both also cat people, so whatever. But I have a feeling that he's going to decide he needs an upgrade, and like, she's not hot enough for his extremely high personal standards. Also, he was hitting on waitresses like at his bachelor party, so he's that guy. He's like a big, clearly on the apps kind of a person.
So
that's another
gross
danger zone to watch for, which is fascinating. Good job with the casting this season. The other two couples seem fine. So that's Married at First Sight.
Wow. That was a lot.
It's a journey.
Yeah.
So,
well, good luck to you all.
Indeed. So for my plugs, for my plug rather, this week Hulu is doing a thing because, as you know, there's not a lot of new TV. They've imported 5 new shows from Britain. They're calling it a British binge-cation, so each day they're dropping a season of a different show. I reviewed the show that, as we're recording this, came out today, Tuesday. It's called Max. It's about this guy played by Oti Fagbenle from The Handmaid's Tale. He's a former boy band member. Boytown was the biggest boy band of 2006. Now he's a has-been, but he's trying to mount a comeback. Christopher Maloney plays Don Wilde, his former manager, who now thinks he's bullshit. Does that sound great? Of course. Is it? No, it's terrible. So I'll link my review in the show notes because it was a big disappointment.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
All right, Joshua, what do you have, and are they happy now?
So one thing I'm watching is actually Sarah's pick for the week. So I'm gonna let her go for that one. But otherwise, I'm in like a spot of malaise. I feel like it's a ridiculous thing to say, but it feels like there's nothing on. And I think it's just because there's nothing that a lot of people are talking about in my circle. So I've kind of just been rewatching Hannibal and Twin Peaks: The Return. And you know what? It's really rewarding. Hannibal is one of my favorite shows, and I've only seen it twice through.
Yeah.
I figured it's time to do that again. And this time with the commentary. So I'm taking Brian Fuller along with me. I'm also just watching Twin Peaks: The Return, because I've only seen that once when it aired, and it just seems like, you know, something worth like reconsidering outside of like, it's happening now, oh my god, with that distance. And I really, really like it a lot still. So yeah, it's just me having a good time with some old pals.
Yeah, I hear you. There's something about, and this might be like an age thing, I'm certain it's going to be one of those generational divide things, but there's something about not having new shows in the ether just existing on terrestrial TV or whatever, you know, when you can just turn it on and you're going to watch a rerun of Friends or whatever, right? Versus, like, I used to watch The Simpsons in syndication all the time. Like, we went from, like, 6 episodes a night when we lived in Canada, and, you know, we moved around, and as things, you know, we got further away from prime Simpsons, you know, we get, like, 1 episode a day or whatever. But it was on, I would watch it. Every single Simpsons episode is available 24/7. When is the last time I've actually watched a Simpsons episode?
It's been
sought
years.
It out? Years. And I love The Simpsons, you know, those first 7 seasons or whatever. So it's interesting, but I feel like part of it is just like in the first world problems. Pop culture discovery, such work. Like, that is like the big money crack that nobody's really done yet, right? Because there's so much out there. Like, even just if you take Netflix by itself, like, there's probably 20 shows on Netflix that I would be really into, but there's no fucking way for me to find them. Like, their algorithm sucks. There's no way to do a deep dive into the catalog that I can figure out. Like if I wanted to spend one day going through every British comedy A to Z, nope. You know, there's no way of doing that on their app. So it's kind of frustrating that way. But let me ask you, Joshua and Sarah, rumors of Hannibal being resurrected in some way. Excited? Too little, too late? Find where it was? What do you guys think?
So I'm someone who likes the weird art house, like, imperial phase indulgence that Hannibal season 3 goes for. So I would love it if it just kept doing that just in a different way. And it sounds like that's what it was, because, like, for the longest time, word was Fuller and everyone else kept putting off doing an adaptation of Silence of the Lambs because the rights were tangled up. That's separate from what they have the rights to adapt. And last he spoke about it, and I think it was last year, was that, like, that's off the table because there's a Clarice show happening still, maybe.
And,
And he came up with something totally different for season 4, and it sounds cool. I would watch it. I like watching handsome men who can't admit they have feelings for each other. just like, you know, like, try to, you know, respectively commit and stop murders instead.
What do you think, Sarah?
I mean, I definitely watch it. I think that I think it had a perfect, like, place in the universe as both this very collagey interpretation of murderous homosocial emotion. And also this beautiful visual tapestry. And then they just put it on Friday nights, and sometimes they would air it at 8 o'clock. And when I was covering it for previously, I was like, guys, there are actually people home on Friday. Like, you really need to just move this to like 10 or I don't know, 1:30 in the morning. Like, people who love this show will still find it. It's fine. But the fact that there was ever a space for this extremely weird, gorgeous, dark, fucked up show, like, I hope that we still have that place. And there is always a place in my eye holes for Mr. Mads Mikkelsen. So, yeah. I mean, I'm in. I would like to see what they do. Well, we did an extra hot great recently about like how we would peacock eyes NBC shows, and weirdly, like, Hannibal already did that before Peacock existed. So,
yeah. Joshua, what do you have to plug?
So for my personal work right now, I'm currently a TV and film critic at The Verge. I have another project upcoming that I can't quite, I don't think I'm okay to say what it is just yet, but I should be able to any day now. So this puts me in a weird spot.
Well, tell us when you can, and we will replug it on the podcast whenever it
and let everybody is hear and let everybody here now know what your Twitter is or whatever.
Yeah, we'll
plug that. They can follow you and then discover what this mysterious project is about.
Yeah, just follow me at JMRivera02 for a surprise.
Ooh. Sarah D. Bunting.
Last Chance U has returned for its final season in this iteration on Netflix. This is season 5. They have changed venues once again to Laney College in Oakland, California. There, I mean, it's like basically the same. The show works for the same reasons, but there are some different circumstances, namely that Laney College does not have dorms. It does not offer scholarships. So that is like, between that circumstance and the fact that we are now watching this, like, this was all filmed in 2019, and that we are now watching this from the other side of the like ravine separating us from the before time, it points up even more, I think, this season, the same thing that the show has always pointed up, that basically the plantation capitalist system of college sport, which is specifically cast as like it wants to be seen as a meritocracy and a, quote, great opportunity for everyone involved. But it's really only ever an opportunity for people to like endanger their brains and sleep in their cars for the privilege of playing junior college football so they can play D1 football so that they can continue to be the foundation on which this shitty system is built. Hashtag pay the players. You've all heard me say this a million times before. I will leave it out. But I am super excited for the show to sort of dogleg into college hoops and how these same problems play out in that sport. It'll look a lot the same, but also a lot different. Joshua, how much of this latest season have you seen?
I've only watched like the first episode. And I appreciate, I only sort of like what, I didn't really watch the last season as much as I was like aware of them and heard people talking about them. And I was really appreciative of, you know, sort of like approach that it takes. So right now I only really know how the establishing work going into like how Laney is different from the other schools that they followed.
Yeah, that's all I've seen of this season so far. I definitely recommend it. It has this Friday Night Lights feel to it, that it's like enough football so that you understand the stakes, but if you're not like really a sports person, it's like, it's enough football for you to understand, how, you know, the plot, so to say. So yeah, Last Chance U, the whole season dropped on Netflix, like as you're listening to this yesterday, and it's, I think, 8 episodes this time, with everything, you know, waves hands vaguely the way it is. I'm not sure how or where they're going to film the new one or when we're going to see that. But this series as a whole is, I think, really worthwhile, even for people who are not sportsy necessarily. I think there's a lot to dig into, especially at a time in history when we're thinking a lot more about divides and how they're created or maintained.
Yeah. Just to piggyback off of that, sorry. It reminds me a little bit of America to Me, the Starz documentary.
I liked that.
Which it shows like young people sort of like navigating a kind of compromise system and like kind of aware of it, but also like this is their only shot, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I really have to watch that show.
It's so good.
Yeah. You've said, and you know, my list grows ever longer. And the fact that Love After Lockup is on it is probably a priority challenge that I should meet better than I do. Here's why I tell myself I watch Love After Lockup, because of what I'm about to plug, which is my True Crime in Review newsletter that I do with our past esteemed colleague, past esteemed guest, Eve Beatty. It's at bestevidence.fyi, and you can get a paid subscription. We would love it. But most of our content in these troubled economic times is free, and we would love to have you join, get the latest true crime that's worth your time, and you'll also be able to find out from there what's happening on the True Crime podcast The Blotter presents. So once again, that's bestevidence.fyi.
All right, coming up on the next extra, extra hot grape. Oh, finally. It's the final Goop Lab examination of the final two Goop Lab episodes. We're dealing with mediums and like instant soup. Those are the topics for the next two.
Basically.
One I don't care about, one I get kind of angry about. So if you enjoyed past Angry Goop Dave, tune in. That is available to all supporters at any level at patreon.com/extra hot grape. And then next week, right here on EHG Prime, it is Frayed from HBO Max with guest Christina Tucker, who is a frequent contributor to autostraddle.com and co-host of the Unfriendly Black Hotties, great name podcast, returning from hiatus soon. So check us out.
Great, great podcast, great name, great guest.
It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week is our guest, Joshua. Take it away, Joshua.
Yeah, so I thought about this way too much. Like,
those are the best kind.
Yep.
And then I decided I would settle on This Extraordinary Being, the sixth episode of Watchmen, the HBO series. That is a sequel to the comic of the same name. By Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. This, if you just have like passing memory of the show, is sort of like the big black and white flashback episode, which, by the way, Watchmen is the leader in Emmy nominations for one show right now. They were just announced today.
Yeah.
Am I correct? It has like 26 noms.
Yep.
So yeah, I'm not coming from a particularly unpopular opinion here. So this episode is essentially the origin story of a character called Hooded Justice, who in the Watchmen universe, both the show and the comic book, is like the very first superhero, or they're called costumed adventurers. And it hinges on this small change from both the comic book and also the characters on the show's understanding of history, is that everyone thinks Hooded Justice was white. No, he was not the first superhero in the world. The way that this show starts to bring this about is that there's like this drug called nostalgia. And Gene Smart's character, Agent Jespicek, Laurie Blake, Jespicek's the maiden name, sorry. Agent Blake is explaining to Angela Abar, a.k.a. Sister Knight, the protagonist of the show, what she has just done, which was overdose on this drug called nostalgia.
Do you know how nostalgia works? Or how they make it? You know, they insert these little chips into your brain and they harvest your memories. You know, and then they put them in a little pill and you pop one and you get to experience that shit all over again. It was supposed to be for older folks, you know, a dementia treatment, but that limited the market because, you know, who wants to be in the present? We can live in the past.
So the premise of this episode is that she has overdosed literally on her grandfather's memories. And throughout the show up until this point, we don't really know who this guy is. We've only just found out that he is connected to her. instead of just, you know, telling us who he is, it just shows us. And throughout the episode, which is mostly in black and white, we see William Reeves' life unfold as Angela sort of like experiences it as if it's her. So black and it's sort of a lot of like bleeding back and forth. Anyway, that's the basic setup of the episode. The reason why I think it is worthy of being canonized is because what it does, which is kind of the project of the whole show, it's very much about sort of recentering narratives, recentering our ideas of like superheroes, of who gets to be the protagonist of our aspirational fiction, and also our history, our actual real American history. And it does this through this story of a man who was a child saved from the Tulsa Race Massacre. There's a very literal allusion to the Superman story where he is, as a child, put into a basket and sent out of this dying world, right? The collapse of Black Wall Street, and becomes this figure of justice, right? And decides to become this corrective force in the world, right?
And they find him he goes in a cornfield too, doesn't he?
So the episode starts to get at these ideas like very slowly, right? It kind of like eases you into what it's sort of doing, because at the same time it's like a big revelation, but it also works as like a short story. We pick up in his life after knowing, you know, where he came from, as he becomes a cop in New York. He is there with someone who becomes like, you know, his love interest, who is also the only other person saved from this massacre with him. So he survives this with June, who's a baby, he's like a toddler or like five. And this June is like a baby at the time, and they survive together and ostensibly grow up and fall in love. And June serves like as his conscience throughout. So he becomes a cop, and June is sort of confronting him about it in the second clip.
I know what you're thinking.
What am I thinking?
I've joined the enemy. The police in this city smother our people under their shoes. Lieutenant Battle is a Tom, and now I am a Tom too. They just hired me for the publicity, and besides all of that,
you worried about me.
They gave you a gun and a stick. That's what I'm worried about. What you gonna do with them? Because you are an angry, angry man, William Reeves. I'm not angry. It's okay. Most of us are.
I'm young. I'm healthy. I got the job I always wanted. What have I got to be angry about?
Folks were murdered right in front of you. Right in front of you. The whole town. All of them. Your mother and your father.
That was a long time ago. I don't want to live in the past.
And that, Will Reeves, is why you are so goddamned angry.
This episode is very much concerned with the idea of justice, right? And Will Reeves becomes a figure of, you know, of justice, the one that he understands, right? Law enforcement. If only he was someone like him, had a badge, maybe the thing that happened to him wouldn't happen anymore, right? But that doesn't work out, because the police force is sort of infiltrated by a white supremacist group named Cyclops.
You ain't gonna get justice with a badge, Will Reeves. You're going to get it with that hood. And if you want to stay a hero, townsfolk going to need to think one of their own's under it.
He survives a lynching attempt, which was just like a stern warning from the white supremacists working with him as police to not go after like a Fred Trump-esque figure who like burned down a Jewish deli, and he locked him up for it, or he attempted to have him locked up for it. In his, you know, rage at surviving this lynching attempt, he stops an assault and beats up the criminals and decides to become a vigilante. I think that this is particularly profound coming at a time where, like, superhero fiction's everywhere. But superhero stories aren't really concerned about anything specific when it comes to sort of, like, ideas of, like, good or justice or evil. You know, like, the Avengers are kind of glorified cops, vague notion of noble, right? That's sort of like the best that we kind of get. They accept the world as fundamentally okay. The premise of a lot of superhero fiction is that people want to be good, and we have institutions that sort of like will protect that good and preserve that good. And if there's something wrong, it's because it's something, there's an outside influence taking that in. And Watchmen dispenses with that because we know it's false. Our institutions can be and have been corrupted, both in the past and in the present. All you can do with a batch sometimes is just uphold that corruption, uphold that sort of oppressive force. Because of the reality of racism, what William is told here is that if he wants to become this symbol, if he wants to be a superhero, people aren't going to accept him unless they think he's white, which very much parallels this idea that we've just seen played out, right? We've seen it played out through blockbuster movies that, like, you know, non-white actors don't sell, that women don't sell, that this persistent idea of white is neutral. And this, I think, is central to my argument of why this belongs in the canon, because this idea of the canon tends to follow this very, you know, sort of like long history of a narrow group of people pulling from a narrow group of experiences and a narrow group of a narrow selection of taste, you know, deciding what's good and important, right? If we're going to have more complicated conversation, if we're going to complicate that as a culture, we need to complicate our canon, and we have to be willing to like aggressively deconstruct it and like build it again, right? But build it again in a way that acknowledges the inequitable history, right?
Right.
And so that's why this episode in particular spoke to me for this exercise, because it's very much about, well, we have, you know, all these institutions of power and these ideas of justice and things that we gravitate towards, but they're all built around this, you know, power, and power that's held by whiteness and these systems of white supremacy that have been upheld in ways that we don't necessarily know or realize that we're perpetuating or supporting at the time. Hooded Justice, after operating for some time, the idea of a superhero is found, it catches on, right? It's really sexy. And other people start doing it. And William is approached by Nelson Gardner is the character's name, but he's also Captain Metropolis. And he starts a group called the Minutemen, and he wants it to be like a Justice League. He wants it to be like a group of crime fighters working together to do what one of them couldn't at all. But it's all bullshit. All it turns out to be is a marketing stunt, right? A photo op for a bank sponsorship, right? Like, they just want to be influencers, really? Like,
also, the poster for the bank is extremely racist. Like, it's an illustration of Captain Metropolis arresting someone, and it's like this terrible caricature of like a black perp that he's got holding by the collar.
This added frustration of like, even when, you know, someone who's been marginalized has an idea, right, that could fix things, that could be could gain traction as a solution, right? It's immediately co-opted and then made marketable, and then the status quo is just reasserted in a different way. And this comes to a head towards the very end, where William discovers an operation, an actual mind control operation by the Cyclops, is what they're called, the white supremacist KKK adjacent or involved. They're sort of like interchangeable, right? The way the show uses it.
It's like when James Bond meets the first person in the evil organization, but that evil organization is actually working for the even more evil organization. It's
yes.
Sort of the same hierarchy.
Yeah.
And then Cyclops has the same sort of like Bond villain-esque delusions of mm-hmm. power and grandeur, right?
Yeah.
They know the cultural assumptions we have, the racism, the undercurrent of racism in our culture. And so their plan is just to lean on that and use a sort of like mind control device in a black movie theater to cause everyone to just commit violence towards each other. And so William unearths this plot, and he has evidence for it, and he calls Captain Metropolis, and he wants the Minutemen to shut this down. And it does not go well.
That book I found. Cyclops is...
Yes, yes, yes. Cyclops, Cyclops, Cyclops. Dear God. So the Klan is using mind control? Do you have any idea how ridiculous that sounds? Have you been drinking?
No.
Well, maybe you should be. Come over. You can bring your red file and we can talk about it.
I don't want to come over. You need to get the others and come down and help me. You said you would help me.
I'm sorry, William. But this sort of thing isn't really the Minutemen's cup of tea. I'm afraid you're going to have to solve black unrest all on your own.
That conversation is gutting on, like, multiple levels. One of the things that happens throughout the episode is that Nelson and William have a sexual relationship, right? They're both in the closet. Nelson should know what it's like for William, right? And he just does not give a shit because he's fine. He got what he needed. He has decided that this is not profitable, that this is not a productive use of his brand and clout.
It's like he's the commissioner, but also the budget commissioner for this group, where without his approval, nothing happens.
And it also leans into this thing that, like, threats to marginalized people are always seen as, like, deranged or hysterical or crazy. The episode catches up to the present, or not quite the present, the beginning of the series, where this old man is found by the sheriff of Tulsa, who has appeared to have been hung. And it doesn't seem possible for this wheelchair-bound man to have hung the sheriff, but, like, right now he's the leading suspect. And it turns out that, you know, this man was William Reeve. And he knew that the sheriff was secretly a Klansman, or at the very least, Klan affiliated. He decides to come to Tulsa in the show's version of 2019, because that's when it's set, and confront him using the portable version of the mind control device he found earlier to get the sheriff, who's played by Don Johnson, to listen to him and follow his directions. And he's pretty much telling him to hang himself. And they have a conversation just before this happens.
What's happening? Who are you?
Justice.
Whatever you think I did, you don't understand. I'm trying to fucking help you people. You don't know what's really happening here.
You have a Klan robe in your closet.
Granddad, I have a right to keep it. It's my legacy.
And you're so proud of your legacy. Would you hide it?
You don't know me, old man.
When he asks him, you know, if you're proud of your legacy, then why do you hide it? It's very much like this striking parallel, right? The reaction that anybody who wants to speak frankly about the reality of racism is faced with. It's like stark denial. It seems like the only thing that you're allowed to say is that racism happened a long time ago. But we got better at it, you know? But you're not even allowed to sort of, like, talk too frankly about sort of the extent of that racism, or what it looked like, or how awful it was, because all of a sudden then people will start to qualify it. Like, people didn't know better then, or, you know, they were just working with what they have, or, you know, like, the founding fathers took good care of their enslaved people. Like, no, like, if we know, we knew that it was wrong then, right? Like, this was a big, you know, point of, like, our founding, right? This contradiction was brought up, you know, that defensiveness has been rebranded as pride in history, right? The thing that was done is not characterized as our history, but the way we're supposed to feel about it has been. Watchmen is sort of like making the argument that you can't separate that. It's all in the service of laundering a very simple thing, which is that you don't think someone else is worthy of being considered on the same level as you. And that assumption has informed and been the rot at the center of so much of our history and our stories. And that's it, I guess. That's this extraordinary being.
Okay. I will go first. Thank you for bringing this to us. This is such a great pick for Watchmen because it's like such an excellent encapsulation of the whole series. I had forgotten how well it just retells the whole story. I was sort of thinking because Sarah hasn't watched it. I was like, oh, she's going to be lost. And I was like, nope, this is the whole thing. This is like brings her right up to date. In fact, if this was all that she saw, it would be a pretty good place to start, actually. And you're so right that the one of the issues that I kind of had with the show going into it, and Dave will remember how mad I was at the beginning of the series, is how it starts with really subverting a lot of the ideas in the Watchmen book in a way that was like, it takes a long time to get to its point, and the point is this episode, mm-hmm. and it really trusts the audience to go with it for a long time to understand like what the argument is that it's actually making. And, you know, I hope that people didn't bail before this, because there's a lot of stuff in the first episodes where it's like, does the creators of the show think that Alan Moore thought the problem with society was that cops didn't have enough guns? Cause I don't think that's what he thought. But you know, it gets there. And I think that the argument that you are making about this episode is exactly right. It's a perfect dismantling of copaganda in such an urgent, angry way, and especially through the lens of the superhero story, which is like the ultimate copaganda because it's so disguised. Yes.
Well, but also that that the Minutemen are the capitalist interest in
right.
the story, that
yes.
Mm-hmm. you can take a organization that is supposed to be for justice, and you add capitalism, and now that is mired, is twisted, its direction changes, mm-hmm. and you mm-hmm. can't really scrap back from that. Like, how many institutions today now need a, as Joshua was saying, like, it just needs a reset, right?
Yeah.
Like, everything from the cops to the AFI top 100 films of all time,
mm-hmm.
you know, as you're saying, like, the canon, whatever that might be.
Yes.
All these different categories from pop culture to politics to mm-hmm. institutions, they all exist because of they all exist today in the way they do because of the status quo of the last, you know, 100, 200
right.
years, right? That
right.
they are all created by white people trying to keep white on top. That is extremely hard to press a reset button on.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that it is easy then because you control all the mechanisms to co-opt something as soon as it starts.
Right.
Right. And that's what happened to Hood to Justice yeah. in this.
Right.
Yeah.
And in terms of like, you know, the idea that superheroes are glorified cops, there was an episode last week of the excellent podcast Citations Needed. Mm-hmm. Where they've been doing they just finished a 3-part episode about basically portrayals of Muslims as basically, there's no good portrayals
Mad
of Muslims.
Bombers and
yes, yeah. in pop culture, and they wound it up with how they're portrayed. And a part of the last episode was about in superhero movies, and they did a whole thing about how the Captain Marvel movie was basically a huge commercial for the Air Force, and like they had mm-hmm. they played footage from like a red carpet appearance of like a various real, you know, enlisted people going to the Captain Marvel movie, and like, how exciting is it for you to see as real life superheroes to see yourself portrayed on screen?
Geez.
And like, it was so barfy, but it's like exactly the same thing that we see in this episode with Captain Metropolis and the bank act, like writ large, except yeah. in real life. And like equally is a commercial for U.S. imperialism abroad, you know.
And it's all questions of opportunity and resources when it comes to being able to do exactly that, like to co-opt something that quickly. Mm-hmm. It's easy when you got all the money in the world and all the power to move it around.
Right. So the sneaky through line of this episode is like, as bad as Cyclops and the Klansmen are, like, which is quite bad. Mm-hmm. The truest villain in some ways is Nelson Gardner, who is, you know, the person who brings Hood of Justice in and then is like, oh, yeah, we're not going to deal with your you're going to have to solve black unrest on your own, because this seems a little grubby for the new Minutemen. Sorry. Like, you know, that this is what white allyship is portrayed as in this episode, is like, oh, that's rough. And also, yikes, too close to home and accurate. OK, you know. So, like, there's no punches pulled in this episode, which is what makes it so urgent and so good. And I will just conclude with two quick remarks. Jovan Adepo, who plays young Will Reeves in the episode, also played Regina King's son on The Leftovers. So that was a nice reunion for the two of them. And at the end, when it's Regina King and Will Reeves' body flashing back and forth.
The mannerisms.
She's so good at capturing like the physicality of Lou Gossett Jr. At the end of his life.
40 years older than her, probably.
At least, minimum. But I just had in my notes, like, she would not have to mesmerize me to tell me to kill herself. Like, Regina King could just give me a straight instruction, like, whatever you tell me to do, you got it, lady. this was a fantastic episode, truly the high point of an excellent series of which, you know, despite its many Emmy nominations today, I hope they do not make more of. It was fine as it was. We don't need more.
Yeah, we often talk about letting good things just rest and just be. Yeah, and just this is one of them. It felt like the perfect amount, the perfect story. It had an ending.
Should we let Sarah go next? Sure. Do you want to close it up? Sure. Okay.
I had not watched Watchmen. I had seen a lot of people on my Twitter timeline talking about how it seemed so prescient as they were sort of rewatching it now in 2020. I'm not actually sure when, like, what were the air dates? Was it actually,
it was last fall.
Did any of it? Okay. Yeah. That is what I thought. But I didn't want to misspeak in case some of this did overlap with, but regardless, like, it was created in the before time. So, in some ways, like, it really seems like this hour of art has encapsulated everything that we're talking about in this year. You have, like, people walking around an office setting with masks on. You have the Tulsa massacre made not explicit, but like that this could seem almost didactic or like a primer for 2020. And it's as a result, you have to keep reminding yourself that this is not looking back at the preoccupations of specifically 2020 about racial injustice, about institutional bias, about representation, about COVID. This is just this has always been the story. And looking at it from that perspective, like, you do have to keep reminding yourself, because you're watching it in 2020, when it was made and what it is trying to tell you from its own standpoint. And with that in mind, it's really quite an impressive, I mean, aside from being beautiful / sometimes horrible to look at, beautiful to listen to, wonderfully acted. I mean, Regina King, like, what else can you say? She's the goddamn best. I realize that doesn't need to be said. Here's me. This was really a sort of, I don't want to say like fascinating, it sounds a little clinical, but it's really such an interesting episode to unpack in terms of staying up on a tightrope of like talking about the sort of big abstractions that like just create anger and injustice, in such an effective way that you don't feel like it's too, like you're being lectured. So this really was a masterclass in a lot of creative things, but also in suffusing a narrative with belief, I guess, or historical justice seeking, which is incredibly hard to do. So just on like a slope rating, as they say in golf, this is quite something. And I was thinking that I should go back and watch the rest of the series, but now it seems like I don't have to. So
I mean, you should,
I'm not sure. But I mean, if it's a lot more Regina King and Jean Smart, I am here for it. I also wanted to note that among the other sort of like, lines of dialogue is like, okay, the president is Robert Redford. Like that is really a prismatic reference when you sit with it for a second. And I also enjoyed, you really think Roosevelt's going to save us? Mm-hmm. Eleanor, maybe. Like, yeah, okay. Like just sort of these lines that you're like, okay, like I get it. But then you have to pause and just sort of contemplate like, what, but did I get everything in there? Like there are layers upon layers. So yeah, thank you for bringing this to us to discuss, because I'm still ruminating.
Yeah, I think on top of the things that you were talking about, Sarah, that the show is doing all at once, the other thing it's doing, and you don't have the background, but like they do a really good job of extending and incorporating the original Watchmen story into this new, like the original Watchmen story is like a Cold War story, fable, not really a fable, but it's all about the Cold War. And this one's all about race in America. And the way that they rewrite Hooded Justice was so smart. Mm-hmm. It's a retcon, but it works. They did it very deftly. I felt like they threaded the needle very well. And so much of this series, like the whole thing, hinges on that switch, where in the original Watchmen, the intent was like, here's all these guys in the 30s dressing up, fighting crime, and race wasn't a consideration when that was created. And you flip the script here, where it's all about race with Hooded Justice as the first superhero, and how what he wanted to do was crushed by power structures that he could do nothing about that have been in play for centuries. And all that happening, still staying true to what I think the Watchmen wanted to do, which was deconstruct a part of American history. And mm-hmm. I think, what's his name? Damon Lindelof does very well here too. The rest of the series incorporates more and more of the actual characters of the Watchmen. This is sort of like a bottle episode, mm-hmm. With the nostalgia flashback, but it is so effective and it says so much in its 1 hour. It just seems like this could have been made yesterday. You know what I mean? Like, it seems like a reaction to what's happening in the last month rather than, you know, it actually playing in the fall. Obviously, it doesn't take a soothsayer to extrapolate all the shitty trends that have been happening in this country for the past few years. But I have to say,
decades.
Sure. But like, in regards to police inaccountability, you know, like it has gone exponentially crazy in the last year, I would say. As it gets attention. A lot of this is because there are eyeballs on it now, right? More eyeballs on it now. But it's just like, it seems like, I know this was last fall, but it kind of feels like they just made it a couple of days ago in reaction to everything that's happened. Right. You know,
different people have different access and different voices and, you know, have more ability to say and to like to publicize. And, you know, it just, more and more, it's what I always say, which is that systems of power exist for their own perpetuation, and that's across all kinds of power that there are. Yeah.
And David, also, you got at something that I also wanted to stress about this episode, in that it's kind of also a warning, not for tomorrow or next year, but like decades from now, because in the fiction of Watchmen and the present of that show, everyone thinks Hooded Justice is white. He gets written out of his own story. If, you know, we're fortunate and we have a relatively successful way to confront the problems that are facing us, right? Are we really going to credit the people who actually did the work, you know? Or are we just going to let someone like who, you know, I don't think Elon Musk is smart enough to pull it off, but he would very much like to be the guy who swoops in and solves our problems. Right. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So that's sort of like the meanest punch the episode has.
So let's put this to a vote. Tar Ariana.
Absolutely. Yay.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Yay.
And me too. So that's me. Watchmen, Season 1, Episode 6, This Extraordinary Being, you hereby inducted into the Extra Hall of Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for our winner and a loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
I do. Despite Watchmen setting new school and pools this year for Emmy nominations, Netflix actually leads HBO in total Emmy nominations. A few other noteworthy surprises from around our desks. The Mandalorian was nominated for Outstanding Drama. Well done, Baby Yoda. What We Do in the Shadows was nominated for Outstanding Comedy.
Woo!
Couple of posthumous nominations that we enjoyed. Lynn Shelton earned her first posthumous nomination for directing Little Fires Everywhere, and Fred Willard was nominated posthumously for Modern Family. Look, you can't have everything. Even Ted Williams only batted 406. Angela Bassett was nominated for guest actress for A Black Lady Sketch Show, and Black Lady Sketch Show and Drunk History were nominated for Variety Sketch Show, which is always nice to see. With that said, I'm just going to segue into give Tar the loser handoff, because these are not perfect. This is not a perfect process. Where is Rhea C. Horn's goddamn nomination for Better Call Saul? Where? And why is Toni Collette nominated for Unbelievable, but Merritt Weaver and Caitlin Dever were not? Look, I love Toni, but come on.
Yeah. Also, in the variety talk show category, Colbert and Kimmel were nominated, but not Seth Meyers or Desus and Mero. Bullshit.
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe we're losers for caring about the Emmys. I don't know.
There's that tension between, like, you know, I'm furious that, like, Rita Moreno or, like, Gentified or Vida or anything, you know, like, Latinx was not getting much any love at all. And so for that reason, I'm like, yeah, the Emmys are dumb anyway. But there's also this other impulse where it's like, no, we got to win them all. Let's win them all. And then no more Emmys.
Shut the door.
We do have a proper loser, though, and it is the Ellen DeGeneres show. The most open secret has been that the Queen of Nice is actually not that nice and that working on her show is hell. This is occasionally there are eruptions of stories about how bad it is to work there. But a couple of weeks ago, there was a BuzzFeed story that actually had 9 people talk about their experience on the show. And it has finally led to an investigation about basically what a toxic workplace this is that might cause people to, like, an investigation by the studio.
By the studio. Okay, yes. Got it.
Not a reporting investigation.
No. I thought it was like a labor board.
Like people. I believe people possibly getting fired.
Studio just CYA-ing it.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think she's going to get fired, but some producers who were named in the story might.
Sure. Yeah, that's the way it works.
Speaking of toxic workplaces, do you know what time it is?
Regulation game time?
Is it game time?
It is. Sarah, can you keep score?
Yes.
All right. It is non-regulation game time. We are between seasons. which means we play a non-regulation game so that Dave may participate.
Yay!
I have written a game. It is called Enemies, a Hate Story. This one is all about TV characters who hate each other.
Okay.
It's very straightforward. I'm going to give you the name of a character. For 2 points, you tell me whose nemesis they are and what show they are from. So, for example, if I said Ned Flanders, you would say?
Homer Simpson.
From?
The Simpsons.
That's correct.
The Simpsons.
Clarification.
Yes.
2 points for them as a unit or 1 point apiece?
That's, you get 2 points for naming both of those things.
You have to name both those things.
Yes. If you need a hint, you can either ask what show the nemesis is from.
Got it.
Or the character whose nemesis they are. And if you can answer the missing piece of information after that, then you get 1 point.
I understand fully.
Okay. Couple of notes.
Got it.
Some shows are in the game more than once. Much as a friendship can exist for a reason or a season, some of these nemeses were only around for a short period of time. Might not be the ultimate nemesis for a person. Basically, the person whose name I'm going to give you first is more likely to be a guest star for a series regular.
Mm.
It'll be obvious once we start playing. So sometimes these characters started out nemeses, ended up fucking. There's a fine line between love and hate. And some of these nemesis relationships are one-sided, meaning the object of hate does not know that the person who hates them hates them.
I was about to say an example, but I'm not going to because
you
it's probably in the game.
Because it might be in there. The viewer knows the person who is hated does not.
Right.
So there's 36 questions and a tiebreaker. Because it's non-regulation game time, we're going to skip steel meals, mm-hmm. gross worth equalizer zones.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what the winner gets, we'll do what we did last time to make it fair, which is in addition to the glory, the winner gets the honor of gifting 3 steel meals to any other regular season player. Sarah.
Can you spread out the love if you so wish?
Sure.
One to this, two to that?
Why not?
Okay.
So Sarah, valued guests, or if you wish me, I don't expect this outcome to occur, but you know, I'm not to say it. So let's throw it to Picky to see who is going to go first.
We will start with Sarah.
So let's say our order is Sarah, Joshua, and Dave. Are we ready to play Enemies, a Hate Story?
Yes, I am, you jerk.
Yes.
This is my favorite hazing ritual.
Sarah, your first question is, your first nemesis is Emily Thorne.
Emily Thorne.
I'll accept first names if you don't know that.
Okay.
Grading on a curve.
Is the nemesis of Victoria on Revenge?
Yes, 2 points. Very good. Mm. Straight out the gate. Joshua, your nemesis is Diamondback.
Oh, that's the nemesis of Luke Cage on Luke Cage.
That's correct. For 2 points.
Yeah. Boy, you know what I was thinking? I think it was DuckTales. It just seemed like a DuckTales character. Uh-oh, Diamondback. Get in the plane. No. Whatever.
Yeah. All right, Dave. Yeah. Your nemesis is Mimi Bobek.
Uh-oh. Mimi Bobek is a name I recognize.
Mm-hmm.
But that is all I recognize from it, that I recognize it.
It may have come up in previous game times.
Yeah, Mimi Bobek.
Yep.
All right, so I can ask for either the show or the nemesis.
That's correct.
I will ask for the nemesis.
Drew Carey.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's her. Right, right. With the moo-moos and the makeup from Drew Carey show.
That's correct for 1 point.
Thank you.
It's good. Well asked.
Thank you.
Okay, back to Sarah. Your nemesis is Bunny McDougal.
Bunny McDougal.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh.
Canada's first prime minister.
Could I have the nemesis, please?
Charlotte York.
Oh, right. Bunny. Jesus. Sex in the City.
That is correct for 1 point. Very good. Okay, this is a little bit of a tough one, but if you think it out, you may get it. Joshua, your nemesis is Sean, no last name.
I want to say Michael's nemesis on The Good Place.
You're right. Good job.
Nice. Oh, yeah.
Wow. Nice pull.
Damn. Very good. Okay, back to Dave.
Uh-huh.
Your nemesis is Matt Bevers, a.k.a. just Bevers.
Oh, Bevers is from, it's from Broad, Broad City. Mm-hmm. He is the roommate question mark that's always there. Mm-hmm. He's actually not technically the roommate.
Right. He's the roommate's boyfriend.
So the nemesis is Abby.
That's correct for 2 points. Good job. Okay, back to nice. Sarah. Your nemesis is Rafi.
Rafi. I feel like this is the league.
That's correct. For 1 point.
Yay. He's kind of everyone's nemesis, and I don't remember the character's names, but I think he's more... I actually cut a gif of this, too. What is fucking Nick Kroll's character's name? Nick?
Is that your guess?
Yes.
You get 1 point for knowing it's the league. The correct answer is Ruxin.
Yeah, that's his name. Yeah, I would have never remembered that. Wow.
Okay, back to Joshua. Your nemesis is Beverly Leslie.
Ooh, okay.
Oh, right. Got it.
This is tricky. Can I get... Let me get the show.
The show is Will and Grace.
Okay. I do not know Will and Grace, so I'm going to say Grace.
That's not correct.
It's Karen.
Correct. Karen is the correct answer.
He's the old dude,
yeah,
right?
It's Leslie Jordan. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, Dave, I have a good feeling about this one.
Okay.
Your nemesis is Awesome X.
All right. Awesome X is from Frisky Dingo.
That's correct.
His nemesis is Killfix.
That's correct for 2 points. Very good. All right. Back to Sarah. Your nemesis is John Allen Hill.
John Allen Hill?
Yep.
Not Glenn Allen Hill.
Nope. John Allen Hill.
Could I have the nemesis, please?
That's a good choice. Carla Tortelli.
Mm. Oh, cheers.
That's correct. For 1 point, he's the guy from upstairs at Melville's.
Oh, yeah.
Right, okay. Right.
And they end up fucking. Spoiler. Yep. Back to Joshua. Your nemesis is Tim Canterbury.
Tim Canterbury. This is also a name I do not recognize. Can I get their nemesis?
Their nemesis is Gareth Keenan.
That really helps.
Yeah. Good luck on this one, Joshua.
It's probably a show you've watched.
What are those names again?
Let's see.
Tim Canterbury and Gareth Keenan. Tim and Gareth. No guess?
No guess.
The British office.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Eventually.
I was going to say like Broadchurch just as a gag.
Oh. Okay. All right, wow. Back to David T. Cole. Your nemesis is Zoya the Destroyer.
Oh, okay. So Zoya the Destroyer is the wrestling character from GLOW.
That's
so
correct.
Her nemesis would be Liberty Bell with an E at the end.
That's correct for 2 points. Didn't ask for spelling, but go ahead and show
up. God, I missed that show.
Yeah. Okay, back to Sarah D. Bunting. Your nemesis is Jimmy Pesto.
Jimmy Pesto?
Yep.
May I have the nemesis, please?
Bob Belcher.
Oh, Bob's Burgers.
Correct for 1 point. To Joshua, your nemesis is Jim the Vampire. It's on his business card and everything.
Yeah. Crap. See, my problem is I just want everyone to be friends.
It's a bad game for you,
I don't see the world through this lens. Jim the Vampire is... What's their nemesis name?
Nemesis's name is Laszlo Cravensworth.
That's What We Do in the Shadows, man.
Good for 1 point.
Great, that's what...
Weird randomizer. Well, I'll just say Ray Bloody Purchase, Dave.
Ray Bloody Purchase's nemesis is Stephen Toast from Toast of London.
That's correct. I shouldn't have said anything if they were back to back in the randomizer, but that's how that worked out. All right. Let us do a score break. We're halfway through the game, roughly.
All right. At the moment, Joshua has 5 points, I have 6 points, and David T. Cole is trampling us both with 9 points.
Dave. Still pretty close. You know why?
Because I live on Spike and Ink. I'm very in tune with everybody's nemesis.
All right. Back to Sarah D. Bunting. Your nemesis is the baby with the one eyebrow.
I knew that was coming up.
I don't know. Can I have the nemesis, please?
Maggie Simpson.
The Simpsons.
That is correct for 1 point.
That baby has a name, too. It's like Norman something.
Does it?
Yeah.
Oh, I missed that. Okay, sorry. To Joshua, your nemesis is Devin Banks.
Ooh. Oh, my God. Can I get the nemesis name?
Yes, Jack Donaghy.
That's the 30 Rock.
That's correct for 1 point. To Dave.
Yes.
Villanelle.
Gerard Sampson is the baby.
Is the baby?
Yes.
Okay. Wow.
I'm sorry.
Villanelle.
Oh, Villanelle. Okay. Her nemesis is... Okay, it's Killing Eve.
Yep.
And it's Eve Pulaski? Pulaski? Pulaski?
I'll give it to you on Eve. It's Pilastri.
Pilastri.
That's good for 2 points.
Thank you.
Okay.
Sparky.
Written on a curve.
To Sarah D. Bunting, Jim Halpert.
All right, well, that's The Office.
That's correct.
I mean, but who's nemesis? I didn't watch The Office is the problem. I guess I'll say Michael Scott. I don't know.
I think Dwight would agree. That's his nemesis.
Right, him.
Okay. Back to Joshua. Your nemesis is Reverend Richard Wayne Gary Wayne.
Wait, that's a real character?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I feel like if I don't know, if I'm chuckling at their name, I might also just chuckle at their nemesis name. So I'm going
to
go with...
I think either hint's going to lead you to the same place.
Probably so.
Yeah, probably. Yeah,
probably. Okay. Let me do the nemesis name.
Kimmy Schmidt.
Ah, well, there you go. That's right. That is his name. He's Kimmy Schmidt's nemesis and the unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
That is correct. Very good. Back to David T. Cole.
Yeah.
Hamilton Berger.
Hamilton Berger is the lawyer from Perry Mason.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, here's where it gets tricky. Well, are we talking about... Okay, it's his nemesis is Perry Mason.
Yes.
Okay, fine. All right, well, in the new one, it's sort of, you know,
right.
it's fluid.
Well, he hasn't been on long enough in the new one to have a nemesis okay. yet. I right. the old
In the black and white one, they're always yes. opposing counsel.
Okay. Yes. To Sarah D. Bunting, your nemesis, Glory.
Oh, right.
Glory.
Yep.
That's
okay.
Good.
Glory's nemesis is Buffy the Vampire Slayer on Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
That's good for 2 points. To I'll Joshua, your nemesis is Cam Winston.
This is another one I feel like I should know. Huh. Cam Winston. I'm just going to say it really slowly. Just Cam Winston.
I'm going to say this is another one where you have a good shot with either. Either hint and
mm. All roads lead.
Yeah, home. Yeah.
Cam Winston. Boy, that sounds familiar, but I can't.
All right. It does. I'll just go with their nemesis.
His nemesis is Fraser Crane.
Oh! Right.
Fraser Crane from Fraser. Yeah,
correct.
That's the upstairs neighbor.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
That they're always fighting.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, back to David T. Cole. Your uh-huh. nemesis. The Monarch.
Okay. The Monarch's nemesis from the Venture Brothers.
Yes.
Is Dr. Venture. Mm-hmm. Officially.
Yes.
By decree of the Guild of Calamitous Intent.
Yes.
Is that what it is? Yeah.
Yes.
Dr. Venture.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
It's good for 2 points.
You're nodding your head like,
Rusty
I need
Venture.
To provide more information.
I was expecting his first name, but that's fine.
Oh, okay.
Sarah DeBenting, your nemesis is Patty Levin.
What's the last name?
Patty Levin.
Okay. That's the leftovers, I think. And her nemesis is the Mableton police chief's dick in sweatpants. Why can't I think of this character's name?
Right.
The chief of police.
Mm-hmm. His name.
Guy.
I'll take his first name.
Is Benson.
Well, you get 1 point for the leftovers. His name is Kevin, as she pronounces it.
Kevin. Of course.
Okay, back to Joshua. Your nemesis is Madeline Wunsch. Wunsch with a W.
Wunsch with a W. Yeah, I'm going to need their nemesis.
Her nemesis is Raymond Holt.
Oh, my God. That's Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
That's correct for 1 point. David T.
Yes,
Cole.
Ma'am.
Jim Moriarty.
Oh. Jim Moriarty is from Sherlock.
Yes, that's correct.
His nemesis is Sherlock Holmes.
That's correct for 2 points.
Gosh.
Sarah DeBenting.
You didn't even need to watch TV for that one.
Your nemesis is Boyd Crowder.
That is Raylan.
Correct.
From Justified.
Correct for 2 points. Back to Joshua. I have a good feeling about this one for you. Joker.
Oh, wow.
Multiple show possibilities for this one.
Yeah. Well, what's the show? I'm going to say he is Batman's nemesis from Batman.
That's correct. If you had said Harley Quinn's nemesis from Harley Quinn, I would have accepted that too. Okay, back to Dave.
Yeah.
Your nemesis is Lieutenant Peanut Butter.
Oh, Lieutenant Peanut Butter is Charles Boyle's horse nemesis from Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
That's correct.
I was trying to remember equine nemesis.
Equine nemesis. Okay. Equine, yeah. Everyone's got 2 questions left. What are our scores, please, Sarah DeBenting?
It remains close-ish.
Okay.
At least in the back of the pack. Joshua is at 11. I have 13. And Dave has 19.
Damn. Look at him. Pump
so
those
I guess
arms.
It's not that close.
Okay.
Is it?
As I said, everyone's got 2 questions left. Sarah DeBenting, your nemesis is Mary Louise Wright with a W.
Mary Louise Wright. Could I have the nemesis, please?
Celeste Wright. Nemesis in a family.
Celeste. I don't know. Veronica Mars. I don't know.
They are from Big Little Lies. It's Meryl Streep
and
Nicole Kidman.
Oh, shit. Right.
Right. Streep. Got it.
To Joshua, your nemesis is Dr. Ogden Wernstrom.
I don't really know this one. Can I get the nemesis?
Sure. Your nemesis, his nemesis, rather, is Professor Hubert J. Farnsworth. That will either help you or not.
Yeah. No, it's putting me in. I feel like it's an animated show. Okay. Is it? I don't know. Futurama.
Yes.
Yeah.
Nicely done.
Nice.
Good for 1 point.
I was like Deadwood.
Yeah.
You know what?
Kind of.
It's not far off. Okay.
I can see that.
To Dave, yeah. Your second last question.
Okay.
The janitor.
Oh. Okay. So, the janitor is from Scrubs.
Yep.
And his nemesis is JD.
That's correct for 2 points. Okay, Sarah, your last question. I pray this is in your wheelhouse. Greg Pakaitis.
Greg Pakaitis. Okay, it's Parks and Rec.
Yes!
And it's Nope, Leslie Nope.
Yes! I couldn't remember if that was one of the ones they made you watch.
It was.
My favorite movie. Okay,
that name is perfect, too.
He's the kid. He's like the cranky, teenager. Uh-huh, uh-huh. Okay, Joshua, your last question. Nemesis is Gunther.
Ooh. Oh, my God.
Wait. Hang on. Before you answer or ask for a clue.
Does that help?
That was a little bit.
Oh my god, no.
Okay. Do you want a hint? Nemesis or show?
Yeah. Give me the nemesis.
His nemesis is Ross Geller.
Oh my god. Friends.
That's correct for 1 point. Dave, your final question.
Yes.
Kilgrave.
I know that name. Kilgrave is the purple man from... Is he? Is that him? Kilgrave? Purple man from Jessica Jones?
That is correct.
So Jessica Jones.
Correct. Good job.
Nice.
Let's get those final
Speaking
scores.
Speaking of Broadchurch. The final scores are Joshua had 13. I finished with 15, and David T. Cole, 23. Well done.
How do you want to assign those three steel meals?
I want to give all three steel meals to the valued guests.
Look at
is
you.
What I want to
Dick.
Do with it.
All right, well we have one. We have a tiebreaker. Let's play it for one more steel meal,
okay.
Just for funsies. Here we go. Newman.
Seinfeld. No. Yes, Seinfeld. Newman. Seinfeld. From Seinfeld.
Okay. One more.
If you say Seinfeld too many times, can it be revoked and reassigned to someone else?
Seinfeld.
What do you want to do with that steel meal?
Belly guess.
All right.
Is that it?
Yep. We're all done. Good job, everybody.
Good job, Dave.
Dave.
Congrats, Dave.
Dave.
Thank you. Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We got in touch with our inner selves for the yoga retreat candid reality show Last Resort before going around the dial with stops at Married at First Sight, Hannibal, Twin Peaks, and Last Chance U. We answered the question who watches the Watchmen get into the canon, we crowned winners and losers of the week, and me, David T. Cole, was the winner of this week's non-regulation game time from Tara. Next up, it's the final goddamn Goop Lab on Extra, Extra Hot Great. And on the next EHG Prime, it's Frayed, which you can watch on HBO Max. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
Goodbye, Newman.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Now I'm triggered.
And Joshua Rivera.
Yeah, let's do a rage exercise.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
No! Back up! Leave me alone! I have had enough! Just back up! Back all the way back!
Oh, man.